And now, please welcome Representative Eric Swalwell and Nellie Bowles to the Inforum stage.
Hi. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm supposed to read this for the radio version. Welcome to tonight's program with Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Nellie Bowles, the Silicon Valley correspondent for Vice Nightly, and I'm so pleased to be in conversation with Rep. Eric Swalwell. So, Rep. Swalwell, let's get started.
Yeah, thanks for having us to the Commonwealth Club, too.
The first thing I want to ask you about is, well, actually, congratulations on getting married this weekend.
I got married on Friday.
Yeah.
I put on a little weight over the weekend, a couple grams, I guess.
I found out via Instagram,
which leads
me to my first question.
And
which,
she's here, my wife, Brittany. Right here.
Your nickname is the Snapchat King of Congress.
It's a low bar. It's a very low bar.
Tell me, what does that mean to be the Snapchat King of Congress? How many followers do you have? What are you snapping?
What are you doing?
What are you doing there on Snapchat?
So when I first got elected, I was one of the younger members of the House, and still am. I was elected in 2012. And so at first, my colleagues, some of them thought I was an intern. I was an intern at one point. And then I think many of us were elevated, the younger members, to IT help desk, setting up other members' Instagram accounts and Facebook accounts. And I went to Snapchat to get away from my mom because she was on Facebook and she was on Twitter. And
spoken like
if I didn't
millennial.
Go to a family dinner, she'd be like, well, I know you're in town because I saw on Facebook that you just, were at this event. So I knew that Snapchat was like where she was not going to go. But I also knew that a lot of my constituents were going there to communicate. And so we use that as a way to, try and keep them updated, bring them into the conversation. And what's amazing is that it's not just a place where millennials and next generation kids go. It's actually all generations now. And so it's one way that we communicate what we're doing and also just get ideas from the folks we represent.
Yeah. What are you snapping, though? Like, actually?
Some of it is just routine. It's like what we're having for dinner, as many of you probably do. Other times it's, a live feed from the House floor as we're doing the sit-in for gun violence. And so, I try and make it 80% just down-to-earth routine stuff that I'm doing to show that, this job is no different than, what our constituents are doing, and about 20% policy. I think if you try and hit folks over the head too much with policy, it's a turnoff. And so,
And then you've started, you have cards now that you hand out?
I'm trying to get more of my colleagues to join Snapchat. And so I've been passing out cards on the House floor, with my snap code and telling them like if they want help setting it up. And so some of them have. Sherry Bustos from Illinois, she always jokes that she's got kids my age. Like, why would she, be on that, platform? But she's actually, I think she's got one of the best Snapchats in Congress, and she's just kind of leaned fully into it. Mm. And so, trying to sign them up just one snapper at a time.
I won't just only ask about your Snapchat, but have you ever regretted a snap? Like, I have never sent a snap I didn't regret.
That's right. It disappears. It's the greatest disappearing act in town, right? Well, it goes to the Russians, and then it disappears to the rest of us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
That's
right.
That makes me nervous. Whoever manages your PR, watch out for his snaps,
guys. He's sitting in the front row. This may be cut off pretty quickly.
In all seriousness, you have used social media in a really unique way. So, like, I was reading a little bit about what happened with Paul Ryan and C-SPAN cutting off. I don't really understand what. Tell me about what went down with Paul Ryan and the C-SPAN cord cutting.
And first, I'll tell you that idea to do that came from, I worked as a prosecutor in Oakland for 7 years. And I learned pretty quickly when I was trying jury trials that the jurors received information in different ways. Some jurors like to see the hard piece of evidence right there on your lawyer's table. Other jurors wanted to hear you recount the evidence. Other jurors like PowerPoint slides. So I realized that people received information in different ways. And so when I had the honor of getting this job, I thought, well, some constituents, it's more convenient to talk to us through social media. Others want us to go out and, you know, stand outside the grocery store and ask how we can help. And others want to show up at a town hall event. And so it's not a silver bullet by any means. It's just one way to communicate. But with the gun violence issue, the Pulse nightclub shooting had just happened. And so we came back from our districts on a Monday morning, and folks were upset at home. They were, you know, asking, how could we have 1,000 mass shootings since Sandy Hook and Congress is continuing to do nothing about it? And, you know, I was pretty upset and others were upset. And we were told by the Speaker of the House that there would be a 1 minute moment of silence, and that was it. There would be no legislation on assault weapons, no legislation on background checks. And so at our Tuesday meeting the next day, it was John Lewis, the great civil rights leader.
Yeah.
He told us at our meeting, he said, my brothers and sisters, I have seen this challenge before. And to make progress, what we had to do was take a seat until others were willing to stand up. Mm. And members of Congress, you know, we're very cautious and we want an end game and a strategy. And so we're starting to ask questions like, well, how long do we sit down? And like, what happens next? And he had this very calming effect where he told us, he said, look, if you're willing to be patient and you're willing to be uncomfortable and you're up for causing some good trouble, I can't tell you what's going to happen next, but it's going to take us somewhere good. So we all went to the House well. We took a seat, first time that ever happened, on the floor of the House of Representatives. And what we did not expect was that the Speaker of the House would cut the C-SPAN feed, which is how the American people watch their democracy. And what should have been expected was that the 35-year-old there would take out his phone. I took out my phone, and I Periscoped and Facebook Lived and Snapchatted what was going on. A couple other members, Scott Peters and Beto O'Rourke, did the same thing. And pretty soon, C-SPAN and the American people were locked out, so they picked up our collective feeds and broadcast that out. And so the most fulfilling part, though, was on Periscope or Facebook Live, you can actually see the comment stream of what people are saying as they're watching the feed. And so we would see that we each had about 100 to 200,000 people watching. And just a constant stream of keep going, continue the fight, please don't stop. Or the one that struck a lot of us, because I would walk around the floor and show people, was finally Congress is doing something about this. So we knew that what we were doing, there was depth behind it with the American people. Now, as I was recording, from time to time, my colleagues who didn't understand what I was doing would, you know, step in front of the feed. And so it was uncomfortable at one point to move Elizabeth Warren and be like, Senator, like, you're kind of blocking the feed. Or Leader Pelosi, like, I need you a little to the left. But she was very supportive.
Was she? It.
Very supportive.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Very supportive. So.
Well, and then you got in trouble at one point for doing this, though.
So there's still an outstanding ethics claim against anyone that took a seat on the floor and anyone that recorded. It did violate House rules, and you know, I would be lying if I said I didn't know that I was doing that, but I felt, you know, John Lewis, you know, had a point that sometimes you have to cause some good trouble, and I didn't want people to be locked out of that dialogue. So we were not just sitting on the floor, people. So this is the House floor, the most formal place in America, where the rules are so rigid and you know, the protocol is so strict. And it was interesting how, you know, the members are sitting on the floor. There's no C-SPAN feed. There's no one in the speaker's chair. But we still found, like, order in that disorder where people would just stand up and tell stories about people in their district who had lost their lives to gun violence. Yeah. And so I really felt that letting the American people in to see that would help make sure the conversation was happening not just on the floor but across the country.
Yeah. You had in trouble for a Vine abortion?
I vined. So when I first got elected, I stumbled upon Vine. And, you know,
dangerous.
It's a seven-second loop.
Yeah.
Yeah, dangerous. Yeah, I tried Vine. And we had a vote. It was an effort to ban abortion, essentially. And so I vined my no vote, and, you know, I put my card in the electronic reader and pressed no a number of times and just vined the vote. And, you know, I wanted to show how we vote, but also where I stood on that. And that was a breach of house protocol. So the rules are very steeped in the 18th century. And so part of what I've tried to do in the house is upgrade the institution. But Nelly, I will tell you, it takes a lot of time for that to happen. Women just got a bathroom on the floor in 2011.
What?
There hadn't been a women's bathroom off the house floor until 2011.
Sounds like a tech conference.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Sorry, that was just I'm a tech blogger.
You're the tech reporter,
mostly.
Yeah.
I just bitter tech reporter. Mm. Okay. Just not to stay totally on this. So let's move the you're also really involved in sharing economy, and you work around the sharing economy. You've started a sharing economy caucus. What does that mean? What are you working on? What are the issues that you worry about?
Sure.
Because like, are you trying to take my Uber or are you trying to take my Airbnb? Because then.
So it started in Antarctica, of all places, the Sharing Economy Caucus. So I went on a science committee trip to Antarctica, and I was one of the only Democrats on the trip. An unlikely partner in this with me was Daryl Issa, represents Orange in San Diego County. And so on this trip at the bottom of the world, the two of us were talking about how Uber and Lyft and other ride-sharing services had kind of gone out of not just being in San Francisco and New York and L.A., but you could be in, where I grew up, Dublin, California, and only have to wait 3 to 4 minutes.
Yeah,
so
great.
We knew the world had changed.
We liked it.
And we also feared, though, that as the world was changing and as it was becoming more efficient and more, costly to get around, that there could be, a lot of regulations that just killed it. Mm-hmm. And so on that trip in Antarctica, we said, well, what if we took other members of Congress, worked with the companies, worked with labor, and found a way to try and protect the riders, protect the drivers, and protect the technology. And so for the last year and a half, he and I have met with labor. We've met with the companies. We've met with consumer groups and trying to just understand what's going on.
Are these companies willing to budge at all? I feel like...
They need to budge. They need to because, if people feel like that, the workers are being exploited or that there's not enough safety for the riders, then, they'll be shut down. But I also think that the way that we, look at how people get around, we also have to budge as well because I think gone are the days where people are just going to stand in the street and hail a taxi cab. They like the convenience.
Which never worked in San Francisco.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And so I think there's a way to make sure that you're protecting all of the parties. So we've been doing that for the last nearly 2 years now.
Yeah. Airbnb in San Francisco, is it, or in the Bay Area in general, is it going to, right now Airbnb is in sort of a moment of cities are striking back against the company.
Right.
Where do you stand on this? Do you think it's a problem or do you like what they're doing?
No, I think that we need to make sure that they're, held to the same standards that hotels are held to and that, there's not discrimination. I recently sent a letter, out of concern about, people discriminating against African-Americans. But I appreciate the convenience. I'll give you an example. My father-in-law was on, had gone to South Florida with his friends right before the hurricane that recently struck. And he had to leave the area he was in, and he was looking for a hotel. And all the hotels were booked. I mean, there was just nowhere for him to stay, and he couldn't get out. And so it finally struck me, let me just look on Airbnb. And we were able to get he and his friends into an Airbnb. And so, again, the world is changing. There's more options. There's more competition. I think that's all a good thing. But as long as you're not exploiting people and, there's standards that protect the workers, I think this will be the new economy and we have to continue to embrace it.
Yeah. Why is it – one thing, the last sort of few months covering tech and Silicon Valley, but then also obviously being obsessed with the election, I've been struck by, in general, how uninvolved Silicon Valley is with DC and with politics in general, other than like Peter Thiel, which...
Yeah, you think he's having buyer's remorse yet?
Apparently not, because he doubled down. Yeah. But Silicon Valley, they just haven't, for such a wealthy area, for an area that is being affected, like you're talking about the sharing economy, like an area that's being incredibly affected by DC, it's surprisingly not interested in politics. Like it doesn't give as much as comparably wealthy areas. It doesn't, you just don't hear it being talked about as much here as I do when I go and visit my friends in New York. What's happening?
I think it's because in Silicon Valley, and actually across California, they're thinking big and we're acting incrementally. And I think that's the challenge, is that they look at Washington as a place that is chaotic. There's a lot of discord, and they don't see much getting done. So they don't think it really matters to participate, because we're kind of in this perpetual gridlock where our budgets are 3 to 6 months at a time. We fund highway projects and extend them 3-month extensions, 6-month extensions. We're not doing anything big or long term anymore. Mm-hmm. And so if they can work outside of that, that's kind of the nature of what made Silicon Valley Silicon Valley.
But aren't they worried that eventually, like, the chickens will come home to roost and the regulation will catch up and they won't have...
I think that we have to, in Washington, be as collaborative as they are. And that's a big part of the problem right now, is that we're not collaborative. And, you know, outside groups, I would say, have been so destructive in this. And I have a few personal examples where I've seen this happen. But the outside influence of money has made people, I think, in Silicon Valley and actually across the country, just think that Washington doesn't work anymore, and that people are so afraid of what they call being primaried, where you're not even worried about, if you're a Democrat, losing to a Republican. You're worried about someone being more to the left of you. And if you're a Republican, it happens more in their party. You're worried about someone being more conservative than you and having a couple $1 million dropped on your head by a conservative group, that you're going to keep moving more and more to the fringes.
Isn't Silicon Valley rich enough to fight back with money?
But again, I don't think they're being, because they actually are thriving in our gridlock, because we're gridlocked, I think, you know, they can continue to do big things. And as long as they're not being blocked by it, you know, why even go into that fire? Why even, you know, go into that mess?
Yeah, that's interesting. God, that's sad, though.
But I'll tell you, a person, you know, I had always heard, you know, the outside influence of money, Citizens United, all this outside money being put into politics. It's poisoning it. So the Chronicle had run a feature when I first got elected about rare earth elements. And, you know, these are the 17 periodic elements on the periodic table that I could never identify at pistol point, right? I didn't know them. Most people never could point them out. But they were so critical to cell phones, jet engines, anti-missile systems. And 98% of them were coming from China. And so China was continuing to have these export controls on them, and the United States was not harvesting any of the ones that we had, or the opportunities we had in the United States. And so the Chronicle did this multi-part series on this problem. And so I thought, well, this is a problem that could use a solution, and try and find these elements in the United States and look at the mines that we have. So I wrote a bill that would have the Department of Energy get involved in the rare earth elements game and have... they would have loan guarantee program for anyone that would go into it. They would explore the different mines to do it in an environmentally safe way. And I got the Science Committee chairman, a Republican, and Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader of their party, to agree to give it a vote if I would take out the loan guarantees, because loan guarantees means Solyndra to them. And so I thought, well, let's just see progress on this. Sure, we'll take out the loan guarantees. So they gave me a vote, and no one made... you know, a single noise on this leading up to the vote. It had been on our docket for about a week. And the day of the vote, Club for Growth and Heritage Action, two large outside organizations, sent an alert to their millions of members and said, if you support this, you will be, any member of Congress who supports this will be scored negatively. So all of a sudden, I had a non-controversial bill that was going to solve a problem where China was just, you know, taking our lunch every day, and hopefully have more export, reduce the export problem here. And so my colleagues were looking at me on the House floor as I went up to them, the Republican colleagues, and I said, well, you know, we don't want to lose out to China on this. We can do this in the United States. And the number of them who looked me in the eye and said, Eric, I like your bill, but I'm afraid of how I'm going to be scored, was disheartening. Because I thought that's the case,
you never want to be a politician.
Just turn over your voting card. But they were worried that Club for Growth or Heritage Action would give them a negative score. And a negative score means they're going to drop a couple million dollars on your head to run someone more conservative.
So
it lost by 9 votes.
Yeah.
Kevin McCarthy and Lamar Smith.
Did you think about going to a startup after that?
They to their credit, what'd you say?
Did you think about going to a startup after that?
Right. Just closing down shop, coming back to the Valley. The two Republicans, to their credit, they voted in favor of it. They kept their word. But
insane.
Too many of them went with Club for Growth and Heritage Action. So it's real.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about two other topics that don't have anything to do with startups also now.
Or rare earth elements.
Or rare earth elements.
Don't make me name them.
No, yeah, I couldn't quite follow the rare earth elements. I was. I read about it before and I still was confused. But
vanadium, that's one.
Vanadium, Jesus. You have interesting takes on affordable housing, and that is like a crisis that is ongoing, despite maybe the real estate market is settling a little bit.
Yeah.
And then also the millennial voting and how none of us seem to vote. There's recently a prop, I don't know if you guys all voted yet, but on the I just did my absentee ballot, and there's a prop to allow 16-year-olds to vote. And I was wondering what you make of that.
We need 18-year-olds to vote first, right?
That's, well, yeah.
That would be helpful. But
yeah, what do you make of that? Like of the sort of teenage voters, and then also just like, why don't millennials vote?
So let me talk first about affordable housing. For me, that issue is personal because I grew up 10 different houses, went to 8 different schools, and my parents, they did that. I was born in Iowa, made my way to California, going to Oregon in between, because they were just trying to find more affordable places for us to live and better schools for me and my three younger brothers to go to. And so it was actually when I was about 15 when they were able to buy their first home. But I saw, you know, kind of firsthand how expensive the Bay Area is and how much putting your kid in a good school is, you know, the
focal politics point for around it have gotten decisions. Especially crazy. Like for people who aren't following the news and all this, like literally there are activists now who want to sue the suburbs for not building more. And then now there's a sort of whole swaths of Silicon Valley that want rent control. And it's in the last year, it's gone beyond just like throwing stones at Google buses into sort of really.
And I've seen this in Dublin. So I grew up in Dublin and I was on the Dublin City Council. And when I was growing up as a kid, I played soccer in the neighboring communities because Dublin didn't have a competitive soccer league. And so I learned pretty quickly that all the kids in the other neighborhoods that were pretty nice had a nickname for us, and it was Scrublin. And so I came home after Scrublin. Scrublin. And so I came home after law school and moved back to Dublin, and I served on the Arts Commission and the Planning Commission and then the City Council. And we took a town that, you know, had a very low four-year college rate. Our high school graduates, about a third of them went to a four-year college. We had the highest unemployment rate of the Tri-Valley. We had the highest vacancy rate for buildings in the Tri-Valley. And over about a 15-year period, the leaders in Dublin, they were able to get BART extended to Dublin Pleasanton Station. Mm-hmm. We attracted high-wage employers. And, you know, they built more and more housing. And so the challenge is today, now folks, there's a lot of folks in Dublin who are saying, you know, don't build another single house or another single apartment building. But the place has a Whole Foods, which I guess is like a rite of passage to say your community has made it. The graduation rate has gone up. Yeah. Now about 75% of the kids go to four-year universities. The unemployment rate is around 4%. And no one in the area calls us Scrublin before. So it's like you're a victim of your own success. You know, you build affordable housing, you build better schools, and then people get a mindset that, well, we don't want anyone else to come in. And that kind of mindset can really price people out of where they grew up and push growth farther and farther out. So I think if you can build housing near transportation, as you know, there's so many opportunities to still do that, you're not going to just see sprawl.
The cities don't want the housing. Do you think? What do you think about the effort to sue the suburbs and to sue them to build housing? Would you be supportive of that, or would you sort of like?
I think
enjoy
you don't
that?
Have to sue them. I think we should give more and more incentives for them to build near transportation centers. So Dublin and Pleasanton and also still in Hayward, there's so much land near the BART stations where I think you can go vertical and have affordable housing there. But in Dublin, they voted down recently a veterans housing project next to a BART station. I mean, you couldn't get any better than that. You're helping veterans who are in need of housing, and you're making sure that you're not putting more cars on the road. But right now people are so, you know, upset. They feel like the schools are overcrowded and the roads are clogged. And so I don't think we're making the best decisions. We're governing for the urgent rather than the long-term important.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I think you have to think beyond just what's right in front of you. And it's hard because I've sat in city council meetings where you have, you know, folks filled like a room like this who are neighbors and they're saying, you know, my kid can't get into the school and we paid a lot of money to live in this community. So you have to, you know, really, I think about this holistically rather than just, you know, one problem at a time.
Yeah. What do you think eventually the solution? How will you convince those Dubliners to allow you to build housing? Or is it a lost cause?
No, I think, you know, we need to expect more from the developers too. And that makes sure that if you're building
you
in a community, you're building
veteran
schools.
Housing by a BART station.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you have to make sure that the community is convinced that if you're going to add more units or more people to the community, that they're going to get a benefit out of it, whether it's more schools, whether it's wider lanes, whether it's extending BART 11 miles out to the Altamont. That's a project I'm working on right now, closing the gap between the Altamont and the Dublin Pleasanton Station. It's 11 miles, but if we can extend BART that far, we can take 30,000 people off the road who are coming from Manteca and Tracy, and those are the folks who are priced out of the greater Bay Area right now, but still work here because it's where the good jobs are.
Yeah. I want to talk about the props. And
the props,
the one for the 16-year-old voters, which I'm fascinated by, but also just the prop process.
Propositions, yeah. We're talking millennial now, right?
Yeah.
Shortening.
Those propositions are a nightmare. Yeah. I was trying to vote the other day, and it was so confusing. Where do you stand on the props and also on the millennial one?
Yeah, so I do support allowing 16-year-olds to vote. I think the best way to get that passed is for 18-year-olds to show up and vote. And so I was at Cal State East Bay today registering young people. And I think it's just, it's too damn hard right now to register to vote. It's not easy at all. And something that's frustrating for me is someone who did my taxes on my phone, who does my banking on my phone, who
your taxes
takes
on
my
your
health.
Phone?
Yeah, you can just get the TurboTax app. I don't have a lot of, I have a lot of student debt, so there's not a lot of income and stocks and stuff. So it's very easy. If you have any of that stuff, I would probably suggest getting an accountant. But I make my doctor appointments, fill my prescriptions. I do all of that on my phone, but I can't vote on my phone.
Yeah. I'd like to be able to vote like I Tinder. Just
Tinder, swipe left.
You know
left.
What I mean? Like that. I think that's it works.
Is it swipe left or right?
Tried and true.
Yeah.
Swipe left for no, obviously.
Okay. Yeah, vote no on 61,
old.
Swipe left. Vote yes on 63.
Exactly.
Got it. But, you know, what I fear is that these Russian hacks into some of the election systems have now made us really question whether we ever want to vote online. And I think that's the wrong way to approach it. And I'll give you an example. The country of Estonia was hacked by the Russians some years back. And their response to being hacked was not to burrow down and go from wireless and everything online to going back to the Stone Age and using everything on paper, but they actually became E-Stonia, and every citizen got an ID with a chip card in it. And so every part of their government, every citizen's interaction with the government, including voting, is done online. So they kind of doubled down. And they said, you know what, we're not going to get hacked again. We're going to make the most secure system possible. So it's a challenge I have for Silicon Valley, which is don't tell me that we can't have a secure online voting system. Let's go invent a secure online voting system, because we are the part of the world that thinks big and moves and puts our shoulder to the wheel to find progress. And so I think we can do it. And it's going to take a moonshot-like effort, but we have the minds and we have the resources. And if we did that, I guarantee you, if you can go on your Postmates, if you can go on Tinder, you can go online and swipe left or right to vote.
How is it recruiting Silicon Valley to get behind you and to, like, how is
it? It's been tough. It honestly, it's been tough. And, you know, software engineers and scientists, they work through, and the reason they are able to be so inventive, the process of falsification, to prove something can't work to get to something that can work. And right now it's really easy to prove that online voting can't work. And really, there's not a lot of you know, frankly, there's not a financial incentive for us to have an online voting system. But my challenge is, if you do not live in Atherton or Menlo Park, and say you live in Maricopa County in Georgia, or I'm sorry, Maricopa County in Arizona, or if you live in a county in Georgia or Texas, you will experience waiting in line to vote for 2 to 3 hours. You will experience polling places being put inside country clubs where if you're not a member, you're going to have a heck of a time going to them. And we've seen that in Texas. And so you don't know what it's like to be disenfranchised and not be able to vote. It's really easy to just mail in your ballot, but that's not the experience that the majority of Americans have across our country. And so getting them to think outside of, you know, our Silicon Valley bubble is also a challenge. And to see that we can actually solve a problem that will make more people participate in our democracy.
Yeah. This is going back, but what do you make of the Peter Thiel situation and him being the most prominent Silicon Valley, the most prominent supporter of Trump in the business world as a Silicon Valley executive?
And it's a beautiful thing about freedom of speech and our democracy that he can do that. But I think he will regret it. He is going to seriously regret it. I think, you know, Donald Trump will probably suffer the second largest loss next to Mondale in 84 is what I think is going to happen.
What kind of looking forward, what does a Hillary presidency look like for our region? Like I have this feeling like Obama coined the phrase, or not coined the phrase, but we introduced the phrase Crackberry to all of us because he was like obsessed with tech and he was like so tech savvy. And I feel like Hillary, I don't know if she has that same enthusiasm for this industry. But I don't know. Am I wrong? What do you see as some of the challenges maybe coming up during a Hillary presidency?
Well, she certainly is collaborative, and I like that about her. You know, the Clinton, when her husband was in the White House, she and her husband were known, and I've heard this from so many of my more senior colleagues, that time after time they used all 16 acres of that White House to have Republicans and Democrats there to build and develop relationships and then, you know, find consensus on, you know, some of the tougher decisions that you have to make. And so that is certainly a Silicon Valley spirit and ideal. And so I think she will act out in that way as president. I think she's going to try and work with Republicans. Now, she's going to take the oath of office on January 20th, likely with her opponent and the loser of the election, claiming that the election was rigged and that she's not the legitimate president. And so Republicans are going to have a choice. They can disavow that, and most of them have not disavowed him now, or they can feed into that, and we can see, you know, 4 more years of just chaos. But the American people, I think, have had enough. And if she is reaching her hand out and genuinely trying to show that she wants to move these issues like immigration reform and reducing gun violence and equal pay for equal work and family leave, all of these policies, if she's willing to, you know, stick her hand out and there's not a hand on the other side of the aisle, I think there's going to be a real price to pay for that.
Yeah. Where do you think she stands, though, on our issues, on the Silicon Valley issues, on the things that we're talking about, the sharing economy and all of that? I know Obama just had a statement about how tech executives what did he say? I think I wrote it down somewhere. I don't know if I have it. Oh, he said, the final thing I'll say is that government will never run the way Silicon Valley runs because, by definition, democracy is messy.
And he went on to point out that, you know, he has to worry about whether everyone has an opportunity, you know, and that it's not necessarily the job of, you know, everyone in Silicon Valley to have to worry about the same things that he has to worry about. And that doesn't mean that what they do is bad. It's just they have different responsibility sets. And I think Secretary Clinton, though, especially when it comes to family leave and women in the workforce, she cares deeply about making sure that more women have ladders to the most executive levels in all parts of America. And I think when you tour Silicon Valley, it's certainly becoming more diverse, but not diverse enough. Mm-hmm. Women are certainly playing bigger roles, but not as big of a role as I think, you know, the population reflects. And so if you have young girls in our classrooms today looking at their mom and seeing that their mom works at a company that has family-friendly policies, I think you're more likely to see that young girl wanting to go and learn how to code and become a software engineer. But if you continue to have policies that are not family friendly, I'm afraid you're not going to see that. And I think she's going to really elevate that issue to a place that's never been in our country before.
That's interesting, actually. Startups, I mean, the startups I cover, a lot of them give, instead of like 401ks or anything like that, they give you perks and in like free beer and things like that.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Vice has free beer, just FYI. Yeah. What is the Future Forum or the Future Forum? What is that group that you are part of?
So after I was reelected and we started the 114th Congress, Leader Pelosi wanted to have a millennial outreach group. And so, again, we for the first 2 years, it's so much of just drinking out of the fire hose. You're learning, you know, how, my opponent, when I ran in 2012, he'd been there for 40 years, and he told the voters routinely that, you know, Eric Swalwell wouldn't even know where to find the bathroom if you were to elect him in Congress. And
you really
he
got,
was right. He was really right. I had no idea.
You got hazed.
Yeah, I had no idea where the bathroom was. So you're just learning.
So you were called intern.
Yeah.
You were...
yeah. But so after 2 years, I felt like, you know, I'd gotten my bearings, my sea legs, and wanted to kind of stand up for issues that I felt like our generation were feeling and experiencing. And so I was fortunate. Leader Pelosi said, let's have a millennial outreach group. You're the largest, most diverse generation. You now have about 18 members who are millennial or millennial-minded. Why don't we, you know, go out and engage with and listen to millennials?
Millennial-minded.
So, millennial-minded. That's like if you're right on the edge, you're millennial-minded. It's not an age, it's a mindset. So we took 18 of the youngest members, and we have gone now to about 23 cities across the country over the last 2 years. And not just New York, L.A., San Francisco. We've gone to Iowa City. We've gone to Chicago, Dallas, Phoenix. I'll be in San Antonio.
And just going and talking to millennials?
We go to audiences like this at college campuses, community colleges, millennial workforces. So we go to a lot of like biotech companies, and we listen. And it'll be about three or four of my colleagues, and we'll have informal town halls. We'll have what's called a word cloud right behind us, so people can and are encouraged to text in what issues are most important to them. They'll take polls while we're talking with them, and we can see and get like a live feedback of what they care about. But it's not your stilted town hall. It's a very interactive experience. And then we take what we hear and go back and legislate. And I'll tell you, Nelly, that the number one issue, 23 different backdrops across the country, but the common struggle is student debt for young people right now. So 40 million young people, $1.3 trillion of student debt, and they are experiencing financial quicksand so much that we are delaying the decision to start a family by about 5 years as a generation. We're the least homeowning generation that America has ever known, and we are, despite the myth out there of us being a startup generation, we are less enterprising than any generation before us. So from 2014 to 2015, 6% fewer businesses were started by millennials. And
really?
So, yeah, it makes sense though. If you think about what a young person has experienced in just the last 15 years, the formative period for us, our personal security was shaken during September 11th. Then you see about a million millennials go off and serve in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. You see that we were misled on the Iraq war, and so a trust in government starts to evaporate. You see that we're not taking care of the veterans who served when they come back home, so our friends who are coming back home are being let down. And then in 2008, the financial crisis happens, and so our parents lose their
homes.
We're
a more conservative generation than our parents were. We're poorer than our parents were.
Poorer and more risk-averse, but we're the most educated
generation. And actually part of the problem with this is like the media blows up the sort of Silicon Valley startup myth, but in actuality, it's very few people who are doing these startups and who are benefiting from these.
And people think, well, you guys can't commit to anything, but the reason we're working as an independent contractor or driving an Uber or working as a task, you know, a tasker, a task rabbit, is because we don't see the same job security that our parents were given.
Yeah. No, the boomers are really the worst generation.
There's that whole like millennials are lazy myth, and it's
so, perpetuated by the boomers.
So frustrating. We have to be task rabbiting. We have no other options.
Yeah. Well, the boomers are experiencing a boomerang right now, though, because so many young people have so much debt that they can't afford to live near where they work. So they move home with their parents. And so the people that understand the student loan debt challenge the most, aside from the student who has it, is actually the boomer parent.
Yeah.
Because you think you sent your kids off to college. They did what they were supposed to do. Now they have $100,000 in debt. They can't afford to live in Manhattan or Los Angeles.
Suddenly you have a 23-year-old home again. After college, I lived with my aunt for about 4 years
when
I worked for the Chronicle, and it was great.
The kicker, though, is what I don't think many people expected was that just as the boomer, the parent, is having their son or daughter move back home, in many cases, and we've seen this across the country, their parent is also moving into costly assisted living facilities, or they're going to move in, and you have three generations in the same house.
Remember, boomers had it easy. They can handle it, right?
They certainly had...
I think...
They certainly had college tuition that was more affordable. And I realized on this tour that I was certainly connecting with any parent who had sent a kid off to college about how much tuition has gone up. But if people didn't have kids who had gone to college recently or kids who had gone off to college, there was just a disconnect. And so we went back and looked at the cost of college in 1980 and going forward. And what we found was that from 1980 to today, with inflation adjusted, college tuition has gone up 300%. So if you were to take a gallon of gas and jack it up 300%, it would cost about $14 a gallon. If you were to jack up a movie ticket, it cost about $35 a movie ticket. And if you were to jack up by 300% a dozen eggs, it costs about $12. So no other good or service we consume has gone up as much as college tuition.
Were you a Berner or a Hillary person on this? Because they have very different...
Mine doesn't even have a name. Martin O'Malley-er. I supported Governor O'Malley.
That doesn't have quite the ring of Berner.
No. I worked for Governor O'Malley when I was in college in law school and was proud to get behind his campaign.
What was his solution for student loans? Just super quick.
It was free. Affordable college. So basically, if you go to a public university, you come out debt-free.
Okay.
And that's something we've done in California before. In the 50s and 60s, if you went to a UC, you came out without any debt. And the return on the investment, those graduates are the graduates that were a part of the hands that built the great California economy, the aerospace industry in Los Angeles, biotech in San Diego, and, of course, the tech economy here in Silicon Valley and San Francisco. So the return on investment was that you had an educated workforce that continued to create and innovate, and it paid itself back.
Yeah.
So we can do it again.
I have been given lightning round questions.
Okay. Marissa's got her cards.
She does. It's true.
She's on point.
To stay on topic first, Lyft or Uber?
Uber. But Lyft is...
Giants or A's?
Giants. And I'm the only
Jay-Z
Giants
Jay-Z or Kanye?
I don't like what Kanye did to Taylor. I'm still not over that. I'm team Taylor on that. Yeah.
The last book you read?
Oh, Industries of the Future by Alec Ross. Great book. It's about automation and this new economy and how we should adjust to it.
Dream dinner party of three people.
They
all have to be tech CEOs.
They all have to be tech CEOs?
I just made it a nightmare dinner party.
Yeah. I mean, of course, I would never turn down the opportunity, with Zuckerberg, of course. Marissa, I think, would be fascinating to meet with. And I love Safra Katz. I don't know if you ever met Safra.
Who's Safra?
Oracle.
Oh.
One of the smartest persons you'll ever meet in your life. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
She's the CEO at Oracle.
These are very intimate. Look at this. Oh, my.
They're earmuffs. Not. Yeah.
Okay, last one of these. Would you rather be on Celebrity Apprentice or Dancing with the Stars?
Certainly Dancing with the Stars, but I'd really hate to see that show go off the television if I did that. Yeah, just for the rest of us.
That's beautiful. That's perfect. Let's open up for questions from the audience. I'll give 5 minutes for questions from the audience so people start thinking of things. What's that? oh yes, line up. And line up over there. I'm supposed to be reading from a special cue thing. And line up over there, yeah. Boy, you got a lot of questions. You nervous? Okay, cool. Let's just go ahead and start, because there are a lot of questions. First up, go for it.
Oh, you do? Oh, great. You did? You went to Maryland?
I did. I grew up in Maryland. So.
Great. And what was your major there?
I was geography major.
Okay. Cool. You know, I was just telling Nellie, did you know that Rachel Maddow grew up in Castro Valley?
I do.
She was the commencement speaker at Castro Valley High.
Yeah. And I was told we were supposed to keep the questions super tight, and you're ruining
it. My question is actually about the override of Obama's veto on... Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know what it's called. It's like the bill to allow 9/11 families to sue foreign governments. Can you share your thoughts on that and what it's going to do to our country, and if there's any hope for Congress to do anything different or change the law or reverse the law?
JASTA was like the legal, like the Washington speak, which was Justice Against State-Sponsored Terrorism Act. And so it wasn't just targeted toward Saudi Arabia or September 11th, but it said it gave a new cause of action for any person in a civil court against a country. It would allow a U.S. citizen to sue a foreign government in the United States under the Foreign Sovereignty Act, where before they had immunity. And so, a lot of folks thought, well, this would open up liability to Saudi Arabia, but you would still have to prove. And I voted. The president vetoed this, and I voted. Along with about 400 members of Congress to override that. And it was President Obama's only veto override. But I personally believe that there were enough protections that it wouldn't be abused because the Attorney General could actually intervene and stay the proceedings if good faith negotiations were taking place with the government that was being sued. I felt like that was a good backstop. But I did believe that any terrorism victim's family should have a cause of action if there was evidence that was proved in a court of law that a foreign government had, you know, sponsored a state terror act. I don't think that's going to happen with Saudi Arabia, which is the fear, but I do think that that is a right that victims should have. And, you know, for me personally, I was an intern on the Hill when September 11th happened. That was a formative time for me, and I had a college housemate who lost his father in the Pentagon. And so I saw what victims' families went through, and feeling powerless, you know, was certainly something I didn't want them or any terrorist victim's family to ever have to go through.
Hi, I'm Phoebe. I'm 19, and I'm interested in getting involved in public policy and government. However, it seems incredibly frustrating and very slow, especially compared to the startup culture here in San Francisco. So why should I pursue a pass with the government instead of with like a business or a nonprofit?
Good question.
Because we need you. We really do need more hands toiling away to help people. And I would say, you know, serve an issue, not an office. And I'm asked often, you know, I want to run for this office or that office. How do I get there? And I really think the best way to do it is find issues that you care about and, you know, reach down and lift other people up in those areas. And then along the way, continue to find mentors in those areas and reach up and find mentors, because you're going to learn. There's so many other people who have already done or are doing what you want to do that really want to impart their knowledge onto you. But I would say do it locally. I mean, there's so many challenges here in San Francisco and Alameda County with homelessness and our veterans and gun violence and domestic violence that, you know, we need more hands. And I hope yours are a part of that.
Hi there. My name is Gus, and thank you for the conversation tonight. I walked in knowing very little about both of you, but I'm definitely a follower now. So I'm relatively new to the area, but
where'd
thank
you come
you.
From?
Well, I spent the last 4 years in Santa Cruz. I was going to school, but new to, I live in Oakland now, happy
Great.
To. But anyway, so I have a question. I'm going to try to be as concise, as focused as possible, but it's based on a reaction that I had to the piece of your conversation that was discussing what we can do about 18-year-olds not voting, like not getting out to vote. And I understand that by talking about things like making it text or like phone accessible, that's based on this desire to make and getting involved with the way that government works more interactive, less disconnected from young people. But as a young person, when I talk with people about why they don't vote, the answer is never because it's too hard or not easy enough. As far as what I've heard, it's more so based on a lack of trust in the way that the government institutions function. So when we have a conversation about how do we get people out to vote, and we talk about making it more easy and something that we could swipe on a screen or something like that, I don't think that that is what we need to do to get young people down to vote. And so I wonder what you have to say about the sort of dwindling trust in the institution piece of why people don't vote.
Yeah, Gus, you have to make them believe that it matters and that it makes a difference. And, you know, one part of persuading young people to do that, I think, is showing and demonstrating through evidence that whether it was, you know, making sure women had the right to vote or expanding civil rights or ensuring that we had same-sex marriage, that didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen just because we marched in the streets were civilly disobedient. It was because, as Martin Luther King always said, we showed up and it was all about the ballot box, the ballot box, the ballot box. And so every, you know, change that has expanded opportunity and freedom and equality for us came because especially young people showed up and thought that it mattered. And if they don't believe it matters right now, we're not doing a good enough job of getting them to vote. But I will also say, and it's hard for us to imagine, because again, it's the most educated generation in our history, we think, well, a woman's right to choose, that debate is over. We have that right. Or same-sex marriage, like we can marry now in every state. But the gear shift, as history has shown, can go in reverse. And as passionate as I am and others are about protecting same-sex marriage and a woman's right to choose, there are people equally passionate who would like to take that away. But I think for young people, it's hard for us to think that that would be taken away. And so arguing that we have to not only move some issues forward, that we have to play defense and protect others, I think is another important thing we have to communicate to young people.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And that's why when you were talking, the thought of making it easier just sort of turned me off, because I was thinking this is something that requires effort. It requires care. Yeah. It's something that not a lot of people in this room have had for a long time, that sort of right to do it. So I appreciate that
response. And make it matter, I guess, instead of make it easier. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Gus.
Hi. My name is Max, and I'm currently a college student.
Where are you going to school?
Berkeley.
Cool.
Yeah. You mentioned the tuition hikes in the UC and student debt, and we are actually probably facing more tuition hikes this upcoming spring. So we've heard a lot about debt-free college and loan relief this election season. So my question is, what can tangibly be done in Congress to realize these goals, or is this just something that we as millennials and as students are being told to get our votes? Yeah.
And so if you're in Max's situation, are you from California?
I am, San Francisco.
So in-state student at Berkeley is paying, with tuition and then room and board, if you're a freshman, about $35,000, a little more than that a year. In-state student, that's what they're paying. And of course, they may get, you know, a Cal grant or some other grants, but that's the entry barrier right now. So I certainly support Secretary Clinton's plan that if your family makes $125,000 or fewer a year, that you would graduate from a public university debt-free. But I also believe that what we have to do to control the constant tuition hikes that we're seeing across the country is start to leverage our ability to lend. So 90% of the student loans out there today are federally backed student loans. But never before have we looked at whether schools are keeping tuition under control, whether they're keeping administrator salaries within the mean. For example, Ohio State University's last president when he left in 2013, made about $7 million a year. And they had the second highest student loan debt amount per student for a public university in the country. We're not looking at the job placement rate within 6 months. And so I think if we looked at those metrics and said, if you keep tuition low, if your administrator's salary are in the mean, if you're placing students within 6 months, you get the most eligibility for aid. And if you're outside of that, your eligibility is lower. And then I think that would drive better behavior. So that's one other area that we're working on. But I think the easiest, most immediate plan will be hopefully President Clinton's family affordability plan that she's been talking about. And I got to credit Bernie Sanders because he talked about it and put it on the front burner.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Smitha. I also go to UC Berkeley. The question that I have ties very intimately into a lot of the issues that you talked about tonight. When we talk about the cost of attending college, it's not just about tuition, but also about housing, largely affordable housing. The UC Office of the President just released a graphic, and it shows that 60%, so much, like significantly more than half of the cost of attendance is related to housing and non-tuition expenses. Now, when we talk about what it takes to attend college, I'm a volunteer with Peer Health Exchange, and we teach health education classes in high schools. I went to Hayward High School, and after a workshop, there was space for students to ask questions about what my experience was and about college, and one student expressed concern over being able to attend a public school, and I mentioned the tuition and the aid, and they talked about, they were like, no, there's just no way to find housing. And if you want to talk about the sharing economy, like housing is very closely tied into that. Most millennials, in fact, a lot of millennials don't really, the idea of home ownership is such a distant dream because sharing is in every aspect of housing. So my question for you is, how can Congress incentivize building affordable housing so that attending college, attending public schools even, and the mobility and opportunity that come with the college experience are accessible to low-income students? And it's important to note that it's not just dorms, because for the first time last year, freshmen weren't guaranteed housing at UC Berkeley.
Right, and at UC Berkeley, after, when they were guaranteed housing, they weren't guaranteed for sophomore, junior, and senior year, right? And also, Smitha, to your point, I also hear from students the housing affordability issue, but also about 25% of students going to school in the Bay Area have food insecurity as well, and so that's a big issue. That even if they can go to the school, they're having a tough time being able to afford to eat. So I think it comes down to priorities. I mean, we have the revenue every year in our budget from what taxpayers and employers contribute, and then it's Congress's job to distribute that revenue and what our values are. And so right now, so much of our budget, nearly $1 trillion, goes to defense. We are, for the first time in about 15 years, not undergoing major combat operations anywhere in the world, yet the defense budget that's put forward year after year in the last few years continues to grow and expand. And I think that's the wrong direction, because I think that money could go to education, it could go to affordable housing projects, it could take care of our veterans who had already served. And so I think it comes down to your values, and your value statement is really your budget, because how you budget shows what you value. And so that I guess would be my 30,000 foot perspective on how we can do that. I've voted every year I've been in Congress against the defense budget, because I think it's too high and it's crowding out these other priorities.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm a millennial voter, and this election has been very...
What's your name?
David.
David.
And this election has kind of made me disheartened about our political process. I look at Donald Trump and his supporters, and I see some of them as what Hillary did call deplorable, who are racist, and they watch Fox News, and they listen to Breitbart, things like that. And they live in a completely different world or universe than, I would say, most people. I guess my question is, how do we get a more informed electorate? I think that this country needs better media, but all, it needs more facts. We seem to have different set of facts. So I guess, yeah, how do we get a more informed electorate? And also, compromise has become a very dirty word in politics, especially on the right. How do we break the gridlock in Washington? I want more hope, and it seems like Washington is pretty hopeless right now.
I sense that as a country right now, we're becoming more and more disconnected, and that people who live in the Bay Area or Los Angeles, Manhattan, Chicago, we're kind of just drifting apart from other parts of the country. It's not intentional. It's not bad-natured. It's just that you're starting to see this disconnect that's going on. And, there's areas of economic prosperity, like here in Silicon Valley, where, traffic is the issue I hear more about than unemployment. That's the number one issue that I hear about is people just too much time in their car, not enough time with their family. But if you, and I've seen this on the tour, if you go, to Iowa, if you go to, parts of Pennsylvania, I mean, you see people who, they see a manufacturing economy that has evaporated. They see very little investment in education in their communities. And they see American companies, largely because of a lot of our trade agreements, making it easier to send jobs overseas where there are lower environmental standards and lower labor standards and the workforce is cheaper. And they're just wondering, where's my opportunity? Where is my hope? And so I think, for one, we need to become more connected and empathetic of what's happening in this country. And I include myself in this. I'd encourage you, go online. NPR has it. It's called a middle class test. And just put Google NPR middle class test, and it's about 50 questions to see how connected you really are to the middle class. And it asks you, like, when was the last time you ate at a Denny's or an Applebee's? What was the last movie that you saw? Do you know any friends who smoke cigarettes? And it's amazing when you start to think about just how different we are in different parts of the country. And so one way I want to make us more connected is we recently wrote legislation that would allow more young people when they graduate college to go and serve in underserved communities across the nation and get student debt relief starting at 2 years in. You get 15% wiped, and then 4 years in, you get another 15% wiped. There's no program right now that gives you immediate student debt relief if you go into nonprofits. And talking to nonprofits across the country, they're saying it's so hard to recruit people, and then once you recruit them, it's hard to retain them because their student debt is so high. So one way to do that, I'd like to just put more people in different parts of the country and just get us more connected. Now, as to the compromising part, I really believe the poison here in our well is the money in politics. And we have to repeal Citizens United, and I'd like to see us go to a publicly financed system so that you take out the influence of any corporations, of labor on our side for Democrats. I think most Democrats and most labor unions would say we'd love to not have to compete against big corporations and go to a publicly financed matching system.
I think we have time for one more.
Hi. Thank you, Representative, for being here, and thank you, Ms. Bowles, for all your reporting. Followed you for a while, and it's been really great. This question is kind of for both of you. Your last answer, you kind of said, I don't think it's intentional that, our test for where we stand has become more and more based on ideological purity. A lot of that, and I want to hear what you guys both have to think about this theory that I have, I just thought of, really.
That's here right happened. Now.
And it kind of struck me, I think it was Dorsey or somebody on the video, the pre-roll video that was going before you guys came up, that Twitter's change might be the most influential technology the world's ever seen. But the follow-up to that, is that good?
Is MySpace.
Exactly. Is that a good thing? Fitting in as part of society is a huge part of human behavior. And the more ideological, if content curation, is about serving you what you want to see the most, how is that affecting our discourse, not only on the ground level, but also at your level, Representative? My representative, I just had a conversation with her, told me, we lived in Washington. We saw each other every day. You know, we had to have cocktail parties and interact with each other. How do you guys think tech is influencing the discourse that we're having?
Yeah. Nelly, go ahead.
I mean, when Twitter first was getting hot, I just assumed that it would be like a great tool for young people and liberals, and it would be like this very humanizing, equalizing tool. And really, the king of Twitter now is Donald Trump. So I'm uncertain, to be honest, whether it makes our lives better or worse. I think it's a bit of a wash, is what I would say. I would say it's a wash. I would say it helps and hurts. I mean, I would want to say that it makes life better, and it certainly entertains me. Like, I'm certainly, my hours are consumed by this stuff, but I don't know that it makes me a better, smarter, more engaged human in any way. I don't know. You're snapping all the time. He was snapping in the green room. He was like,
I was snapping when you were answering that question. You know, they used to say in news, give me two sources or Reuters or two sources or AP. And then that was, you know, how it worked in news. And now, certainly on Twitter, I mean, there's a lot of sources. And I tend to think the more information, the more transparency, the more resources we have, we're better as people. I think it actually makes us...
What if it's more siloed?
Yeah, but I think... It's only siloed if you choose to, you know, stay in that silo. I think.
And what if it becomes this cacophony? Now we're getting all poetic, but it becomes a cacophony. It becomes. I found with this election season, I have been so addicted, and then also just like it becomes this cacophony in my head that I can't. That I don't want anymore. Like, I don't want the Twitter stream. I don't want the Facebook stream. I don't want it.
But I think in this election season, though, don't mistake the vehicle, you know, Twitter, for the cause. I think the cause is not Twitter. I mean, I think the cause is, you know, a candidate who is pandering, unlike anyone ever before, to grievances and really giving these wild, unrealistic expectations to people who have real challenges. I mean, a lot of these people, they're not deplorable. I mean, a lot of them are that are racist and they're violent, but a lot of them, as the last questioner pointed out, they just don't have hope anymore because of where they find themselves. And he's giving them this false sense of hope by saying that the reason you don't have opportunity is because of a Muslim or a Mexican or someone else. And I think, you know, that's the cause. Twitter is the vehicle. But
isn't content curation making that worse?
But I also think there's nothing so bad on Twitter that, you know, we can't, you know, find hope in by the good things that are on Twitter, and that can bring us together.
I have one last question for you.
Yeah.
You ready?
Yeah.
What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Yeah. Can I give you two?
No. No, you can only have one.
I can wrap it into two. So I spend a lot of time...
I have no authority. Yeah. I have no...
First, I mean, being the only one in my family, and the first one in my family to go to college, I do believe the idea, because I think American exceptionalism has always helped make the world better, that if you can ensure every kid, regardless of the neighborhood you grow up in, has a pathway to not college, if that's what it is, or higher education, and they don't have to worry about the cost, that we'll sort that out. That will change the world. Mm. For me, I sit on a lot of airplanes, so here's my other idea, the bonus idea. And you see a lot of kids misbehaving on airplanes, and I'm gonna be there one day.
Where is this going?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so we're in the holiday season, and you have Elf on a Shelf. It makes kids behave. I see this with my nephews. I want, like, Bear in the Air or, like, Thing on a Wing, like, something to make those kids just better behave. And then I can read my Vice News story.
Yeah, you really... You're a true millennial. I think you might be more millennial than I am.
Yeah.
I think that's Bear in the Air.
I don't know. I can call it what you want.
I like that. I mean, listen, you're in a position of power. You can make this happen. This could be your cause.
Well, I guess, you know, if karma has its way, I will, in probably a year or so, have that screaming child, and yeah, I will be the one that everyone is like, can you keep your kid under control?
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, I hope.
You're like, you're like, maybe.
Yeah.
Rep Solwell, this was wonderful.
Yeah, thank you, Nelly. Thank you
so much.
Thank you to each and every one of you.
For coming. It was really fun to meet. Yeah. And thank you, everyone, for coming out.